White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network. Your host for today's show is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy. So get a spot of tea, sit down and relax, because it's time for another show on the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network.
Yeah, coming to you from Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern right here in north central Indiana, near the little town of Warsaw, Poland. I mean, Indiana. Yeah, well, that's right there where our tavern is, and that's right outside our weapons of mass destruction used equipment yard. Yeah, it's closed for the winter now, but and all the boys are hanging out in the restaurant, drinking beer and singing karaoke, man. But we'll be open again in the spring, when it gets a little warmer, and you can come down here and pick out the best weapon of mass destruction that you think will serve your purpose wherever you're at here in the country. And we'll have those Chinese guys helping us out all winter, bringing new stuff in here. Yeah, I know they're Chinese, but they're a hell of a lot more dependable than a lot of white people. You get what I mean, boys? And those junks they've got, they can go up almost any river. Even a big creek, they can go up. So that makes it real handy. I'm going to start off this morning with something I want you definitely to listen closely to. It's an interview with Julian Assange, the head of the WikiWeek outfit. And they're there today. This Swedes have come over to England there to the Ecuadorian office, and they're going to question Assange. Hopefully they'll get him off the hook for this thing he's falsely accused of. He told the Swedish government to guarantee him that they wouldn't ship him to the United States for trial. Otherwise he's not going to come out of there. So I don't blame him. You can't trust the United States government for anything, no matter who's running it. It's interesting, one of the chief of staffs that the Trumpites have appointed is that fellow from Breitbart. And, of course, the left wing accusing of being racist and all that kind of stuff, and anti-Jew and all that. It's baloney. This guy is so pro-Jew, it's unbelievable. Pro-race mixing and everything else. Now some of the right-wingers will say, oh no, Metzger, you're wrong there. He's just pretending. How many decades are we going to have to go through that kind of crap? Once he gets entrenched, he'll do the right thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Every day on his radio show, Breitbart News, he condemns all form of racism. And he does it over and over and over. Now he's part of the government. And I guess he gets, and he helped Trump win the election, too. I don't trust any of these people. Not ever, not all. I'm sorry, boys. If you're still clinging to the conservative right wing, you're out of luck. If you go over to the Jewish left wing, you're out of luck, too. So you might as well batten down the hatches and listen to Tommy.
Of the FBI's intervention in this last week of the US election campaign in the case against Hillary Clinton.
If you look at the history of the FBI, it has become effectively America's political police. And the FBI demonstrated with taking down the former head of the CIA over classified information given to his mistress, almost no one was untouchable.
Mm.
The FBI is always trying to demonstrate that. No one can resist us. But Hillary Clinton very conspicuously resisted the FBI's investigation. So there's anger within the FBI because it made the FBI look weak. Well, we've published quite a number of different sets of emails. So about 33,000 of Clinton's emails while she was Secretary of State. They come from a batch of just over 60,000 emails. In that 60,000 emails, Clinton has kept about half, 30,000, to herself, and we've published about half. And then there's the Podesta emails we've been publishing. Podesta is Hillary Clinton's primary campaign manager. So there's a thread that runs through all these emails. There is quite a lot of pay for play, as they call it, giving access in exchange for money for many different states, individuals and corporations, combined with the cover-up of the Hillary Clinton emails while she was Secretary of State, has led to an environment where the pressure on the FBI increases.
I mean, the Clinton campaign has said that Russia is behind all of this. It says that Russia has manipulated the campaign and is the source for WikiLeaks and its emails.
The Clinton camp has been able to project a kind of neo-McCarthyist hysteria that Russia is responsible for everything. Hillary Clinton stated multiple times, falsely, that 17 US intelligence agencies had assessed that Russia was the source of our publications. Okay. That's false. We can say that the Russian government is not the source. Yes. WikiLeaks has been publishing for 10 years. In that 10 years, we've published 10 million documents, several thousand individual publications, several thousand different sources. And we have never got it wrong.
All the emails that give evidence of access for money and how Hillary Clinton herself benefited from this and how she is benefiting politically are quite extraordinary. I'm thinking of where the Qatari representative was given 5 minutes with Bill Clinton for $1 million check, and many other examples.
$12 million from Morocco.
$12 million from Morocco.
Hillary Clinton to attend.
In terms of the foreign policy of the United States, that's where, for me anyway, where the emails are most revealing, where they show the direct connection between Hillary Clinton and the foundation of jihadism, of ISIL, in the Middle East. Can you talk something about that? How the emails demonstrate this connection between those who are meant to be fighting the jihadists, ISIL, are actually those who have helped create it.
There's a early 2014 email from Hillary Clinton, so not so long after she left Secretary of State, to her campaign manager, John Podesta. That email, it states that ISIL, ISIS, is funded by Saudi Arabia and Qatar, the governments of Saudi Arabia and Qatar. Now, I think this is the most significant email in the whole collection, and perhaps because Saudi and Qatari money is spread all over the place, including into many media institutions. All serious analysts know, even the U.S. government has mentioned or agreed with, that some Saudi figures have been supporting ISIS, funding ISIS. But the dodge has always been it's just some rogue princes using their cut of the oil money to do whatever they like, but actually the government disapproves. But that email says that no, it is the governments of Saudi and the government and Qatar that have been funding ISIS.
The Saudis, the Qataris, the Moroccans, the Bahrainis, particularly the Saudis and the Qataris, are giving all this money to the Clinton Foundation, while Hillary Clinton is Secretary of State and the State Department is approving massive arms sales, particularly to Saudi Arabia. Yeah.
Under Hillary Clinton, and our Clinton emails reveal significant discussion about it, the largest ever arms deal in the world was made with Saudi Arabia, more than $80 billion. In fact, during her tenure as Secretary of State, total arms exports from the United States, in terms of their dollar value, doubled.
Doubled. And of course, the consequence of that is that this notorious terrorist jihadist group called ISIL or ISIS is created largely with money from the very people who are giving money to the Clinton Foundation.
Yes.
That's extraordinary.
Look, Hillary Clinton's just a person. I actually feel quite sorry for Hillary Clinton as a person. Because I see someone who is eaten alive by their ambitions, tormented, literally to the point where they become sick, you know, they faint as a result of going on and going on with their ambitions. But she represents a whole network of people and a network of relationships also with particular states. The question is, how does Hillary Clinton fit in this broader network? Well, she's a centralizing cog, so you've got a lot of different gears in operation from the big banks like Goldman Sachs and major elements of Wall Street and intelligence and people in the State Department and the Saudis and so on. She's the, if you like, the centralizer that interconnects all these different cogs. She's a smooth central representation of all that, and all that is more or less what is in power now in the United States. It's what we call the establishment or the DC consensus and its influences. In fact, one of the more significant Podesta emails that we released was about how the Obama cabinet was formed, and half of the Obama cabinet was basically nominated by a representative from Citibank.
Well,
it was quite amazing.
Didn't Citibank supply a list?
Which, yes.
Which turned out to be mostly the Obama cabinet.
Yes.
So Wall Street decides the cabinet of the President of the United States.
If you were following the Obama campaign back then closely, you could see it had become very close to banking interests. It wasn't so close to oil interests, but it was very close to banking interests.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think you can't properly understand Hillary Clinton's foreign policy without understanding Saudi Arabia. The connections with Saudi Arabia are so intimate.
Why was she so demonstrably enthusiastic about the destruction of Libya? Can you talk a little about just what the emails have told you about what happened there? Because Libya is such a source for so much of the mayhem now in Syria, the ISIL jihadism and so on. And it was almost Hillary Clinton's invasion. What do the emails tell us about that?
Libya, more than anyone else's war, was Hillary Clinton's war. Barack Obama initially opposed it. Who was the person who was championing it? Hillary Clinton. That's documented throughout her emails. She put her favoured agent, in effect, Sidney Blumenthal, onto that. There's more than 1,700 emails out of the 33,000 Hillary Clinton emails we published just about Libya. It's not about that Libya has cheap oil. She perceived the removal of Gaddafi and the overthrow of the Libyan state, something that she would use to run in the general election for president. So late 2011, there's an internal document called the Libya TikTok that is produced for Hillary Clinton. And it's all the... It's a chronological description of how Hillary Clinton was the central figure in the destruction of the Libyan state. As a result, there was around 40,000 deaths within Libya. Jihadists moved in, ISIS moved in. That led to the European refugee and migrant crisis, because not only did you have people fleeing Libya, people then fleeing Syria, destabilization of other African countries as a result of arms flows. The Libyan state itself was no longer able to control movement of people through it. The Libya faces onto the Mediterranean. And so it had been effectively the cork in the bottle of Africa. So all problems, economic problems, civil war in Africa, previously people fleeing those problems didn't end up in Europe because Libya policed the Mediterranean. And that was said explicitly at the time, back in early 2011, by Gaddafi. What do these Europeans think that they're doing, trying to bomb and destroy the Libyan state? There's going to be floods of migrants out of Africa and jihadists into Europe, and that is exactly what happened.
You get a lot of complaints from people saying, what is WikiLeaks doing? Are they trying to put Trump in the White House?
My analysis is that Trump would not be permitted to win. Why do I say that? Because he's had every establishment offside. Trump doesn't have one establishment, maybe with the exception of the evangelicals, if you can call them an establishment. But banks, intelligence, arms companies,
well, they all want him.
Beat foreign money, etc.,
yeah,
is all united behind Hillary Clinton. And the media as well. So media owners and even journalists themselves.
The accusations that WikiLeaks is in league with the Russians, and you hear people saying, well, why doesn't WikiLeaks investigate and publish emails on Russia?
We have published over 800,000 documents of various kinds that relate to Russia. Most of those are critical. Most of those are critical, and a great many books have come out of our publications about Russia, most of which are critical, and our documents have gone on to be used in quite a number of court cases, refugee cases of people fleeing some kinds of claimed political persecution in Russia, which they use our documents to back up.
Do you take yourself a view of the US election? Do you have a preference for Clinton or Trump?
Donald Trump, what does he represent in the American mind and in the European mind? He represents American white trash. Deplorable and irredeemable. Basically the same thing. It means from a establishment or educated, cosmopolitan, urbane perspective, these people are, you know, they're like the rednecks, and you can't, like, they're just... can never deal with them. And because he so clearly, through his words and actions and the type of people turns up his rallies, represents people who are not the middle, not the upper middle class educated, there's a fear of seeming to be associated in any way with that, a social fear that lowers the class status of anyone who can be accused of somehow assisting in any way Trump, including by criticizing Clinton. And that, and if you look at how the middle class gains its economic and social power, it makes absolute sense.
I'd like to talk about Ecuador, a small country that has given you refuge and given you asylum in this embassy in London. Now, Ecuador cut off the internet from here, where we're doing this interview, in the embassy, for the clearly obvious reason that they were concerned about appearing to intervene in the US election campaign. Can you talk about why they would take that action and your own views on Ecuador's support for you?
Let's go back 4 years ago. Right. Ecuador, I made an asylum application to Ecuador in this embassy because of the US extradition case.
Yeah.
And the result was after a month, I was successful in asylum application. And then the embassy has been surrounded by police. Quite an expensive police operation, which the British government admits to spending more than £12.6 million. They admitted that over a year ago. And now there's undercover police and there's robot surveillance cameras of various kinds. So that there has been a quite serious conflict right here in the heart of London between Ecuador, a country of 16 million people, and the United Kingdom, and the Americans who have been helping on the side. So that was a brave and principled thing for Ecuador to do. Now we have the US election on foot. The Ecuadorian election is in February next year. You have the White House feeling the political heat as a result of the true information that we have been publishing. WikiLeaks does not publish from the jurisdiction of Ecuador, from this embassy, or in the territory of Ecuador. We publish from France, we publish from Germany, we publish from the Netherlands, and a number of other countries, so that the attempted squeeze on WikiLeaks is through my refugee status. And this is really intolerable. If you try and get at a publishing organization to try and prevent it publishing true information that is of intense interest to the American people and others about an election.
Tell us what would happen if you walked out of this embassy.
So I would be immediately arrested by the British police, and I would then be extradited either immediately to the United States or to Sweden. In Sweden, I am not charged. I've already been previously cleared, etc.
Yeah.
So we're not certain exactly what would happen there, but then we know that the Swedish government has refused to say that they will not extradite me to the United States, and they have extradited 100% of people that the US has requested since at least 2000. So over the last 15 years, every single person the US has tried to extradite from Sweden has been extradited, and they refuse to provide a guarantee. So it's, yeah.
I mean, people often ask how you cope with the isolation here.
Look, one of the best attributes of human beings is that they are adaptable. One of the worst attributes of human beings is they are adaptable. They adapt and start to tolerate abuses. They adapt to being involved themselves in abuses. They adapt to adversity and continue on. So in my situation, frankly, I'm a bit institutionalized. This is the world.
Yeah.
Visually, this is the world.
It's the world without sunlight, for one thing, isn't it?
It's the world without sunlight, but I haven't seen sunlight in so long. I don't remember it. So, yeah, you adapt. The one real irritant is that my young children, they also adapt. They adapt to being without their father. That's a hard adaption, which they didn't ask for.
Do you worry about them?
Yeah, I worried about them. I worried about their mother.
Yeah. Some people would say, well, why don't you end it and simply walk out the door and allow yourself to be extradited to Sweden?
The UN has looked into this whole situation. They spent 18 months in formal adversarial litigation, me at the UN versus Sweden and the UK. Who's right? The UN made a conclusion. I'm being arbitrarily detained, illegally deprived of my freedom, that what has been occurred has not occurred within the laws that the United Kingdom and Sweden must obey. It is an illegal abuse. United Nations formally asking, what's going on here? What's your legal explanation for this? He says that you should recognize his asylum. Sweden formally writing back to United Nations says, no, we're not going to. So leaving open their ability to extradite. I just find it absolutely amazing that the narrative about this situation is not put out publicly in the press. Yeah. Because it doesn't suit the Western establishment narrative that, yes, the West has political prisoners. It's a reality. It's not just me. There's a bunch of other people as well. Yeah. The West has political prisoners. No state accepts to call the people it is imprisoning or detaining for political reasons political prisoners. They don't call them political prisoners in China. They don't call them political prisoners in Azerbaijan. And they don't call them political prisoners in the United States, UK, or Sweden. It's absolutely intolerable to have that kind of self-perception. But here we have a case, talking about a Swedish case, where I have never been charged with a crime, where I have already been cleared and found to be innocent, where the woman herself said that the police made it up, where the United Nations formally said the whole thing is illegal, where the state of Ecuador also investigated and found that I should be given asylum. Those are the facts. But what is the rhetoric?
Different.
The rhetoric is pretending, constantly pretending that I have been charged with a crime, never mentioning that I have been already previously cleared, never mentioning that the woman herself says that the police made it up, trying to avoid that the UN formally found that the whole thing is illegal, never even mentioning that Ecuador made a formal assessment through its formal processes and found that yes, I am subject to persecution by the United States.
This event through a live stream, as well as many, many international viewers who will be following the video feed that can be found live on the startpage.com website. What does privacy mean to us? How do we value our privacy? When Edward Snowden found out about mass surveillance and mass spying, he felt he had no choice. He felt the only thing he could do, he needed to inform the people about it. He valued our privacy so much that he was willing to give up his own comfortable life as well as his freedom for it. And that's why we feel that he is our true privacy hero. You can imagine that when Mr. Snowden accepted our invitation from Startpage to be present here tonight, that we were both thrilled and really honored. I hope that both the movie and the discussion that will take place later on will add to our awareness about what the privacy challenges are in these modern times. I also hope that it will inspire us to actively defend our values and rights. I wish you all a very exciting evening tonight, and now I'd like to introduce you to the moderator of the evening, an excellent journalist and a well-known television broadcaster, Mr. Roderick Velo. Thank you.
So good evening to all the people, not only here in this wonderful theater of Tuschinski, but also welcome to all the people around the world who are looking now to our feed. We're very happy that everybody watches. We're going to talk to Mr. Snowden, and I hope that Mr. Snowden is already there. Mr. Snowden, are you there? Edward Snowden. Edward Snowden, we are very honored to have you here. We collected a lot of questions from all around the world, from the people here in the audience, and we put them in a couple of subjects, so we're going to start with those questions right away. But first, the movie. Did you saw the movie yourself?
I have, yes.
Yeah. And was it accurate, do you think?
Yeah, so, of course, it's a drama. So there are a lot of things that have been changed. Things like a number of different officials throughout my life in different positions were sort of translated into one big super. And just for the text, so they know I'm hearing myself being fed back on the line a little bit. But the thing that I was most concerned about with the film, the question that was really burning in my mind was, would they get the technology right? Would they get the policies right? Would they get the programs right? And how they're actually affecting our lives. So what is mass surveillance? How does it actually work? How does the government justify it and claim that these things are not only legal, but are actually right? In this context, the movie is actually surprisingly accurate for a drama. And that was something that left me with a good feeling.
Yeah. Did you have a lot of contact with Oliver Stone for the movie?
Yeah, he came out several times and we spoke. I was able to meet with the lead actor as well, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who is a wonderful guy. He's so warm, so charming. I thought we were just going to sort of talk about how things were, what his focus was, talk maybe a little bit about the politics behind how this all fit together and how this came to be. But he didn't tell me, but of course as an actor, what he was actually there for was to try to understand how I move, how I speak, my little mannerisms and things like that. And he tried to put that into the film.
Fantastic. Was the trick, the famous trick with the Rubik's Cube, when you left the NSA, was that real? Happened that in real life? Or is it just a way to, to hide the real reason how you smuggled the chip?
Sure. So I have to be careful in answering this because there is still an ongoing FBI investigation into me. My country's government considers me to be a fugitive. So I'll say this carefully, but what Oliver Stone has said previously is that this is a device for the film because no one knows what really happened. But what I can say about in real life is I did give, prior to leaving Hawaii, everyone in my office a gift of a Rubik's Cube. So there are many, many Rubik's Cubes going in and coming out of these offices past the guards all the time. And that's about as far as I can.
On this way? Like this?
Yeah, the security wasn't quite so hardcore as they show in the film. But yeah, people did carry cubes.
Of course, we're going to ask you some questions about the new President-elect Donald Trump. And the first question is from someone you probably absolutely know. It's Phil Zimmerman. He's the inventor of the encrypted email. Phil, can you come on the stage? No, he's on.
Okay.
I think. Yeah.
Okay. A couple of years ago, I went to Moscow to speak at a conference, and I thought maybe I'd figure out a way to be able to meet you, but that never came to pass. I saw Citizen Four, and I saw that, you know, as you were attempting to connect with Glenn Greenwald with PGP. And he couldn't be bothered to learn how to use PGP. My impression was, go find another journalist. So, when I wrote the PGP manual about 25 years ago, I described in there the idea of that if we build a surveillance infrastructure like we seem to be doing, that it would could be used by a future government that could be elected in a democratic election, that could use it for their whatever evil purposes they might have. And I did the same thing in some Senate testimony in 1996. And, you know, I talk about that, and sometimes in a democracy, bad people can be elected. And if they inherit a technology infrastructure, a surveillance infrastructure, like what we've constructed, then they can use that to hang on to power. And I see that you made that point pretty clear in this story here. We now see that Trump will have a great deal of influence over what the NSA can do. Do you have any thoughts on that you'd like to elucidate on?
Yeah, so there's a number of things. First off, for people in the audience who may not be so familiar with Mr. Zimmerman's work, PGP is one of the original encryption schemes for email that I used in my original contact with the journalists. It's fair to say that the NSA revelations could not have happened in the way they did in 2013 without this man's work. So I have to say thank you very much for everything you've done, not just for myself, but for the world. But going on to the broader question here, I try not to look at this as a question of a single election or a single president or even a single government, right? Because we see these things, these threats coming across borders. We see the same thing happening in Russia. They've got this new surveillance law called the Yarovaya Package. Russians call it the Big Brother Law. In China, on the day of the election, the news was talking about how the Chinese had just passed a new mass surveillance law. And they got away with practically no criticism from the international community because they were clever enough to say that they had modeled it on the United States' own surveillance laws. And because our last two presidential administrations have been saying that these powers were so necessary, they were so valuable, and they didn't hurt anybody, now suddenly they can't criticize these other governments for doing the same thing. But this is a problem, because even if you think, all right, well, you know, we want government to have authority and powers to be able to perform its legitimate tasks of securing the nation, of protecting our communities, of investigating crimes, right? But how is this done, and where do they depart from this model? When do they start creating exceptions to what we have in the United States, our Fourth Amendment, which is an individual's right to privacy, where they say the government can't interfere in your communications, they can't arbitrarily investigate your home or take your letters or your emails, either collecting them or reading them, without going to a court and getting a warrant? But we have to recognize that even that barrier, the warrant requirement, the involvement of courts, doesn't mean the same thing in every country. If you say, well, mass surveillance is fine as long as the court's involved, Kim Jong-un in North Korea will go, oh, this is fabulous, because you know what? I have courts too. And they'll be happy to sign anything I put in front of them. And this is really something that we need to remember, is we are never farther than a single election away from a change in government, from a change in policy, from a change in the way the powers that we have constructed into a system are used. And so what we need to start thinking about now is not how do we defend against a President Donald Trump, but how do we defend the rights of everyone, everywhere, without regard to jurisdictions, without regard to the borders. We have this tremendous fabric of technology that we've enveloped the earth with, this internet that creates bonds of fraternity between people who don't even share the same language. But this fabric of communications that was intended to empower citizens and individuals of communities and families is increasingly being used to disempower them. Internet service providers, phone companies, governments, and other corporations are beginning to spy on these things. They're lifting up that fabric to look at the lives underneath, whether it is for the purpose of profit, or whether it's for the purpose of power, or whether it's for, in some cases, legitimate purposes. But we have to think for ourselves, what if we start weaving this fabric in a slightly different way? What if we start changing that dynamic mechanism that we face in the status quo today, which means when you pick up your phone and you make a call to your mother, your sister, your husband, your wife, that call is transiting that global network electronically naked. Anybody can look at it, anybody can listen to it, anybody can read it. What if we change that so that it's protected by default? Every communication, every transaction you engage with is protected. And you don't have to take some activity. You don't have to teach a journalist how to use this sophisticated encryption program, even if it is 20 years old, and you know you hope that people should be able to get to use it at this point. Instead, we made this fabric work not just for Americans, not just for people in the Netherlands, but for the whole world. If suddenly we could not just support the human rights of people in Germany, France, Brazil, Iran, Russia, China, and America, we could enforce them. We could guarantee them through our technology. And I think this election reminds us that that capability is within our reach today. And we have not just the right to try, but the duty.
I've devoted my career to trying to create that capability. End-to-end secure telephony is what I've been focused on in the last 12 years or so. I had the impression that you might have used something that I made for that too. We went through a lot of trouble to wipe out our email encryption service on the same day that LavaBit did. For what we thought was probably for the same reason. I hope that that helped.
Edward Snowden, are you still there?
Yes.
I am. Can you hear me? Have we lost?
Yeah. No,
I can hear
we
you.
Had a connection.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. Ralph Zimmerman.
Thank you so much for everything you've done.
I think we like to see Edward Snowden all the time, don't you? There he is. Edward Snowden, one more question about the president-elect. The elections. Did you follow the elections?
I did. I think everybody in the world did.
Yeah. So is the outcome better or worse for your case?
You know, for me, I try to focus on the issues that matter the most here. And while I obviously care about what happens to me, I am the least important part of any of this. This is not about me. This is about us. And when I see these changes in government where we see these candidates who are extremely authoritarian, they believe that if we have the power to do something, we should do something. We stop thinking about wrong or right. We stop thinking about should or should not. and instead we focus strictly on can or cannot. These, I think, are civic dangers to everyone. And these are the things that we have to focus the most on resisting, not individual cases, but broad social cases. And this is the thing that I think we begin to forget when we focus too much on a single candidate. The current president of the United States, President Barack Obama, campaigned on a platform of ending mass surveillance in the United States. He said no more warrantless wiretapping. He said he would investigate and end criminal activities that had occurred under the prior administration, in the Bush era. We're talking about torture. We're talking about extrajudicial killings. And we all put a lot of hope in him because of this. Not just people in my country, not just myself, but people in Europe and elsewhere around the world. It was a moment where we believed that because the right person got into office, everything would change. But unfortunately, once he took that office, we saw that he didn't actually fulfill those campaign promises. Guantanamo Bay, the secret prison in Cuba, which he had promised to close on the first day of his presidency, is still open and likely will be on the last day of his presidency. He embraced the policies of mass surveillance, extended them, and entrenched them. And this isn't to criticize this president particularly. This is not to say Obama is what we should be worried about. This is to talk about a broader point, which is we should be cautious about putting too much faith or fear in the work of elected officials. At the end of the day, this is just a president. If we want to build or live or enjoy the fruits of a better world, if we want to make sure that the rights that we have encoded into our laws are actually reliable, that we live with them and pass them to our children, this will never be the work of politicians. This can only be the work of the people, of the population, because politicians do not simply do what they think is best. They do what they think people want to hear. They think they do what they think will gain them support. And ultimately, if we want to see a change, we must force it through ourselves. If we want to have a better world, we can't hope for an Obama, and we should not fear a Donald Trump. Rather, we should build it ourselves.
Okay, other subject. Thank you. A question out of the many questions we got about U.S. companies. U.S. laws like the Patriot Act require U.S. businesses to cooperate with government surveillance. Can we trust U.S. corporations with sensitive information like our email? Or should we prefer non-U.S. companies?
I'm not sure if this is a serious question.
It is.
But I'll answer it as if it were. We have seen real problems with that. There was, quite recently, in the wake of June 2013, President Obama going throughout Europe and saying, these newspaper stories that you've heard about all the spying, they're not very well understood. It doesn't mean what you think. The NSA isn't simply rifling through your emails. Mass surveillance doesn't really exist. These are targeted programs. We're only looking for specific people. And yet, only the beginning of last month, October of 2016, we found that one of the largest email service providers in the United States had secretly gone beyond what the law required, and the law does require a lot of these companies, to scan on behalf of the U.S. intelligence community the emails of all of their customers as they come or go, for particular pieces of information that were provided by U.S. spy agencies. Now, the question that you should be asking yourself is not, should I trust U.S. companies, which it's clear, unfortunately, in many cases, they can't be trusted, but can you trust your own? Are countries in the Netherlands any better? Are countries, are companies in Germany better? And unfortunately, we see a march of these kind of laws sweeping across Europe right now and more broadly the world. The United Kingdom is in the midst of passing the most extreme surveillance measure in the history of any Western society right now, called the Investigatory Powers Bill. which legitimizes and entrenches mass surveillance in a way that would be unacceptable even in the United States, where we've grown quite comfortable with many of these programs. The Netherlands has similar policies. Norway is debating one right now. Germany claimed to pass a reform package quite recently that actually wasn't a reform package. Instead, it legitimized some of the unlawful programs that occurred before. And what we need to start thinking about is, rather than can we trust any company generally, can we start finding specific, particularized companies that can be trusted? Can we look to business models and business practices of particular institutions, corporations, that see you as their primary customer, as seeing you as the one to which they owe the greatest loyalty, rather than to some government, whether it's your own or some foreign government or any other place? And can they prove that this is a relationship that you should trust through their application of technology? I'll simplify this just by demonstrating what I mean in a simpler way. In the midst of that same Yahoo case, we saw there was another telecommunications provider in the United States. This is also October, around the same day. This is an app called Signal, used for sending text messages on your phone or making calls that are encrypted, that are protected, that are electronically clothed. They're armored, like we discussed earlier, as they transit the hostile internet. And the FBI used these laws to go after this company. But rather than doing what Yahoo did and simply giving the government far more than what they asked for, they went to the American Civil Liberties Union, the largest civil rights organization in the United States, and they said, what can we do? And the ACLU said, well, you have to help the government as the law requires, but only what the law requires. And Signal said, well, can we fight this gag order that meant we couldn't tell our customers what was going on? We couldn't tell the public how the government was trying to use our service for the purposes of gathering secret intelligence. And they won. And when they revealed what they actually turned over to the government, it was only this. These black bars are the entirety of the information that they turned over, which are only the phone numbers of the accounts that had been registered with the service, which the government already had. Because the government was saying, hey, pull all the records you have on this phone number. And they said, all right, here are all the records that we kept. And the only information they had was when the account was created and the last time it was connected. Because this company, Signal, this app provider, they weren't spying on their customers. That was not their business model. They weren't collecting records that they could then be forced to turn over. This is very similar to previous times in history when companies had collected a lot of information, but then there were changes, more militarized societies that came over, and then they had to hand over these vast databases of information that were used for the purposes of persecution. We should never enter that kind of world again. And the best way to defend against it is to make sure that you do not collect information as a business that you do not need.
How do you think the awareness of the public is growing or fading already since 2013, since your actions?
Yeah, I mean, it's natural for these things to sort of fade. People don't remember exactly what happened. Many people didn't see the original stories at all. When we go through the kind of things that were demonstrated in 2013, many of you have probably heard of the PRISM program. You've seen it in the film. You know the largest internet companies in the world voluntarily joined this program. You may have also heard about upstream communications, where rather than going to the internet companies themselves, they went to the phone companies. They went to sort of these fiber optic networks that tie the European continent to the American continent, and instead just listened to everything. But you might not have heard of other programs where the NSA was spying on the pornography viewing habits of individuals that they considered to have radical political beliefs. These were Islamists, to be fair, but these were individuals that the NSA's own top secret documents said they did not suspect of violence, and they did not suspect to be actually tied to terrorist activity. They just didn't like their politics. The United Kingdom was collecting images from people's webcams. If you happened to use Yahoo Messenger some years ago when that was a popular thing, The camera that was in your bedroom, they were collecting an image from every 5 minutes, and they were storing it permanently. In Australia, the same infrastructure that the United States government had built, the technology that we had developed and shared, they were using to identify the sources of journalists who had written reports that they considered critical, programs that had been justified on the basis of national security, that they said were going to be used strictly for counterterrorism purposes, had instead been used to target U.S. lawyers, which is actually a violation of law, and not because they thought these lawyers had some special intelligence that would save lives, but rather because they were negotiating a trade deal with Indonesia over the price of shrimp and clove cigarettes. These things will fade, but there is one thing that we should remember. When we look at the investigation into the effectiveness of these programs, the U.S. government's own staff, right? These are not sort of liberal reformers. These are not people who want to see an open society. This board was comprised of individuals such as the former deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Michael Morell. And they found that this kind of mass surveillance that had been justified on the basis of countering terrorism had actually never been useful in that context. It had never stopped a single terrorist plot. And it had never made, and this is the government's words, a quote, a concrete difference in the outcome of any terrorism investigation. These programs were never about terrorism. They were about economic espionage. They were about diplomatic manipulation. They were about social influence. They're about power. And that's what espionage has always been about. Countering terrorism is not an intelligence activity in the traditional sense. That is a police activity. And when we hear people, when we hear spies, when we hear politicians saying, give up your rights to allow us to create these intelligence infrastructures of extraordinary powers because terrorists exist in the world, you should remember that there have always been terrorists in the past. We have always been able to counter them effectively. And we did this through the traditional means of police work and investigation that have always been effective in the past. Why are we proposing to throw away all of the rights that people fought and died to establish over centuries of human civilization for programs that even the U.S. government says were never effective?
Okay. You say mass surveillance is not productive for attacking terrorist attacks. But their intelligence services need some information, a lot of information, to protect the people, they say, and we believe. So what kind of information and what kind of programs need intelligence services to protect us from bombings like in Boston, like in Paris, like in Brussels? If mass surveillance is not appropriate.
Yeah, this is an excellent question, because when we look at the Boston Marathon bombings, for example, this was during the height of American mass surveillance. This was before anybody knew it existed, before it had hit the newspapers, and they were collecting the phone calls of everyone. They were collecting the internet activities of people indiscriminately, just in case they were useful. And it did not stop this attack, even though we had been specifically warned by foreign intelligence services that these individuals were associated with terrorism. Much the same in Brussels. Now, we had known about mass surveillance in a broad sense here, but in the Brussels attacks, Belgium had been warned, by the Turks in this case, that some of these individuals were associated with terrorism. So it begs the question, why did mass surveillance failed to catch these individuals? It's not because they used encryption. It's not because they were particularly skillful. It's not because they were just so clever. It's because when you collect everything, the communications of everyone in a nation, you understand nothing. You get drowned in so much information that you can't find what's actually relevant. If you use traditional means of investigation, gathering indicators, tips from, for example, these foreign intelligence services. You take them to a court. You go to a judge. You say, look, we have some evidence this person has ties to terrorism. We would like a warrant for our police to sneak into their homes, to place a camera, to tap a phone, to follow them as they go through their activities in the day, as we always have for decades at this point. You can watch specifically the individuals who exhibit indications of actually threatening behavior, and then you can catch them in the act. And these are the cases where we have seen it happen. In recent Canadian attacks that have been thwarted, it was not due to mass surveillance, but it was because of the fact that they watched specifically the individuals who they had been tipped off did have these activities, often by members of their family or by their communities, and they watched them. And then when suddenly they collect weapons, they call a taxi cab, and they try to go to a train station, the police are already there, ready to make the arrest and ready to support the attack, and it actually works. The distinction that I want to make here in simple terms, because I know that's a little bit broad, is what people in civil society, what I protest most strongly, is mass surveillance, indiscriminate surveillance where they're watching everyone, targeted surveillance. That's backed by a court where police have shown, look, this individual is more likely than not to be a criminal. We're asking for a warrant to investigate their activities for a period of time in a very intrusive way, but in a very targeted way. We're only watching this individual. We know it is effective because it has been in the past. And we know that this is the least intrusive means of achieving these investigative goals without destroying the rights of everyone else in a free society.
So, yeah. So you say mass surveillance isn't necessary for counter-terror attacks?
That's correct. But let's presume it were. Let's presume it were effective. Would we want it anyway? The challenge here is if we create a government that is so powerful, a structure that is so omniscient, it knows everything that everyone's doing at every time, it can enforce the law perfectly. No one can steal a loaf of bread, no one can speed, no one can commit a terrorist act, no one can murder. A lot of people would say that's fabulous, it's the end of crime, and it's true. But that may not be as unmitigated a good as it seems at first glance. Because when we think about social progress, when we think about the advance of human rights, when we think about the abolition of slavery, when we think about marriage equality, when we think about the prohibition of drugs or certain kinds of alcohol in the past, prohibition of certain types of religious worship, all of these movements were criminal activities in the beginning. Even if it's the enfranchisement of women, allowing them to vote, if government simply says the laws on the books can be enforced and they will be enforced and we will use the full extent of our powers to ensure that is the case, what they're doing is they're halting progress at this moment in time and saying we have gone far enough and no one can transgress against the status quo even for a good reason. No one can organize to change the law if to do so they have to love someone in a way that's not approved. They have to worship in a way that's not popular. They have to do any activity that has not been explicitly authorized in advance by the government. I do not see that as a bright future. In fact, I see it as a very dark one.
I really like to ask you what we can do about that. But first, this is quite a bad situation where we're in now. But I want to make it worse because I have a question about the technology develops enormously. Everybody can buy the software to spy on one another. So how can we stop Big Brother before we going paranoid?
Yeah, so this is a very complex technical question, and I'm very comfortable saying that as of today, we don't have an answer. We have ideas, we have directions for research, but this is not a solved problem. And for the young people in the audience, This is a problem that you could solve. What we're seeing today is the atomic moment of computer science. We're living through it. What nuclear physics had in the last century, we are seeing for this discipline, computer science, today, in our lifetimes. Technologies that we expected to be a benefit for all of mankind are being subverted. They're being corrupted in subtle ways to work contrary to those purposes. And we have to find a way today to change that direction and make it serve humanity rather than master humanity.
This land is yours.
Trust a politician or people with power to hurt you. It doesn't make any difference whether it's a Hillary Clinton or a Donald Trump or whoever. If they have the power, they will turn it to bad things. It always happens that way. So don't get all excited that this guy is going to be save your ass, because the only people that can save your ass is you and your friends, when it comes down to it. We're going to have the same problem with this administration we have with every other administration. I don't know, it'll take quite a while for these right-wingers to figure this out, that you can't trust any politician with power. Don't forget it.